Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mining Conversation with Ms. Teddy. We are looking into the mining industry of South Africa and the podcast is proudly sponsored by Minnow. Today we are joined by Mariette Lieferink and she's a CEO of the Federation for a Sustainable Environment and she's going to be talking to us about illegal mining that is happening in South Africa. With that being said, please do not forget to like, share, subscribe, and follow so that you do not miss any episodes of the Mining Podcast. Let me just introduce Mariette Lieferink. She's a CEO, multi-award-winning environmental activist, research associate, and so much more. With that being said, thank you so much, and welcome to the Mining Conversation.
Thank you.
Wonderful. So just to talk about the illegal mining in South Africa. What are the main causes of the illegal mining?
Yes, it is an important question, and that was also considered by the South African Human Rights Commission. And in their report, they found that not all artisanal or small-scale miners or illegal miners are illegal immigrants. Further, they found that not all are involved in criminal syndicates. They also found that because of the illegal nature of or unregulated nature of illegal mining, that is then amenable to syndicates, in other words, criminal syndicates. It was also found that some communities accept illegal miners, so not all communities are averse to illegal mining. Also, as a result of the retrenchments within the mining industry, because some of the mining industries, such as gold mining, is in decline, and that, of course, then results in some of the retrenchments of experienced miners, ex-miners, and that also results in illegal mining. Furthermore, the socio-economic challenges in South Africa, the unemployment, the poverty, because many mining affected communities are characterized by widespread poverty, that also results in illegal mining. We have to, of course, differentiate between artisanal and small scale mining and then illegal mining. I may also just mention that there are certain loopholes in our legislation. May I talk about that?
Yes, you may.
Yes. Yes. So, in terms of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, if there is cessation of mining or if a mining company relinquishes its mining right, then within 180 days, the mining company must apply for a closure certificate. That closure certificate must also include how air quality will be made fit for current and future generations, how surface and groundwater will be made fit for current and future generations, as well as soil or property and vegetation. That is referred to as a risk assessment. If that is then complied with, then the Minister of Mineral Resources then issues a closure certificate. That is also in collaboration with the Department of Water and Sanitation. When that closure certificate is issued, then the responsibility and the liability, that includes, of course, responsibility for the management of latent and residual impacts, including the pumping and treatment of extraneous or polluted water, that responsibility and liability then again is transferred to the state or the government. The state or government does not want that liability, where the result is often no closure certificate is issued. Within the gold mining industry of the Witwatersrand of South Africa, not one closure certificate had been issued. That then results in mining companies either putting their mining companies in care and maintenance, or they enter into business rescue, or they liquidate. Now, with liquidation, the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act does not require the liquidator to apply for closure, to top up rehabilitation funds, or to implement a rehabilitation plan. That then often results also in mine sites, tailing storage facilities, to be basically without access control, to be without management or mitigation measures, and that also then results in the proliferation of illegal mining. I can also perhaps refer to another loophole in our legislation. When mining companies, such as the larger mining companies with sufficient skills and resources, when they enter into the phase of mine closure, they often, in order to obviate mine closure, they then sell on to smaller mining companies who often do not have the skills or the financial resources or the will to apply for closure. And then in this pass the parcel scenario, often the last man standing would be the scavenger miner or the illegal miner. And that often then also results, of course, in significant environmental degradation and also in pollution, because often the illegal miners make use of mercury for the leaching of gold or even cyanide. And that, of course, also then introduces significant risks and impacts to mining-affected communities.
Okay, so with everything that you've just said, because in South Africa, it is noted that we have over 6,000 abandoned mines, right? And then you say that with the government is reluctant in issuing the closure certificate. Is that why the number is so high? Because in my head, I'm thinking, it was supposed to be an issue when there's like 100 mines that are abandoned. But how do we then get to over 6,000 abandoned mines in South Africa? Will you say that is one of the issues that is causing this number to be this high?
Also because of the historic legislation, okay. It was not required to have rehabilitation funds. Our mining industry has a long history. It has a legacy. In the case of gold mining, it commenced in 1886. Our current legislation, such as the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, it only was promulgated in 2002. Our National Environmental Management Act, the overarching environmental legislation, that was only promulgated in 1998. Our National Water Act only promulgated in 1998. So historically there was not sufficient provision made for closure, for rehabilitation. Our financial regulations to cover latent and residual impacts and the pumping and treatment of extraneous and polluted water was only recently published. That is the reason why there had been, one could say, the opportunity to abandon the mines. I may just mention that within the gold mining sector, there are no ownerless mines. There may be abandoned mines and derelict mines, but not ownerless mines. The only mine dump that has been classified as ownerless is the Davidsonville dump. So all of these tailings storage facilities or mine sites do have mine right holders or have mining companies, but as I've mentioned, there exist loopholes, so often it results in liquidation, care and maintenance, or business rescue, or as I've mentioned, the pass-the-parcel scenario.
So now who do we then blame for this abandoned mines? Do we blame the mine owners or do we blame the government? Who has made this to be such a big issue in our country?
First of all, non-compliance must be enforced. The organs of state that are responsible for the enforcement of non-compliance is, of course, the Department of Mineral Resources. It was historically the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, Department of Water and Sanitation, the National Nuclear Regulator, who is the entity to protect the public from nuclear damage and the property and the environment, because our gold ore co-occurs with uranium and its radioactive progeny. So the National Nuclear Regulator also has a mandate. And then, of course, the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment. So these departments must ensure enforcement of non-compliance. We often find that there is a conflict of interest. The Department of Mineral Resources, their mandate is to promote mining. But at the same time, they are also the player and the referee, because they also must ensure that there is compliance with environmental legislation, the National Environmental Management Act, and then, of course, also to enforce non-compliance. Enforcement of non-compliance can lead to the withdrawal of a mining right that we do not see often. In the case of non-compliance with the National Water Act, the Department of Water and Sanitation can suspend a water use license. So that our experience is that that does not happen often. Often directives are issued, but the directives are not enforced. And I think that has resulted in also the departments, the relevant departments or organs of state, that if they can enforce, even criminally prosecute, delinquent directors, then it can perhaps improve the situation. However, mining companies cannot be exonerated from non-compliance. We have seen in some mining companies, shareholders have put significant pressure on mining companies to perform responsibly. That is why we have seen, after the Brumadinho tailing storage facilities failure in Brazil, the asset managers with more than a trillion assets under management had called upon the mining industry, that is the mines that ascribe to the International Council of Mining and Metals, to then also support the global industry standard for tailings management. And that standard calls for zero harm to the communities, zero harm to the environment, and zero tolerance for human fatalities. So shareholders are also now putting pressure on some of the mining companies in which they invest. We have an example which I, if I may, perhaps mention, where a mining company has been delinquent in fulfilling its responsibilities. It is the mining company Mintails Limited. It was it was on the Australian Stock Exchange, listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, but Mintails Limited, the holding company, the parent company, also had South African subsidiaries such as Mintails Gold South Africa, Mintails Mining South Africa, and so forth. So when Mintails applied for environmental authorization and its mining right, it motivated the application by stating that it is a rehabilitation company. So it then started to re-mine existing tailing storage facilities within the Krugersdorp area to recover the residual gold, but they only recovered the profitable part, and they did not plough back any benefits in the rehabilitation of the in area. They also did not rehabilitate their footprints, and those footprints often contain a residual radioactivity. So that happened from 2006 to 2018. In 2012, they started opening open pits, clusters of open pits close to Kagiso, Krugersdorp and Randfontein, without approval. It was without environmental authorization. And the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Mining conducted an oversight visit and published a report in 2018 stating that Mintails mined without the approval, without an approved social and labour plan from 2012 to 2018. And then the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee made recommendations to state that the directors must be held responsible. They also found that Mintails liquidated with an unfunded environmental liability of 460 million rand. We were involved in court cases in this case, but our case became moot when Pan African Resources acquired the environmental liability of 460 million rand, and currently had been approved to re-mine all the existing tailing storage facilities. Pan African Resources is a mid-tier gold mining company, and it is, we express the hope that they will then re-mine and also rehabilitate the footprints of the mines that had been re-mined. Just to come back to the complex corporate structures of some of the mining companies, as I've mentioned, Mintails Limited was the holding company, and it had South African subsidiaries. When Mintails, the South African subsidiaries, entered into business rescue, the holding company, that is in the Australian listed mining company, then delisted from the Australian Stock Exchange, relisted under another name, Orminex, and spun off its South African subsidiaries in order not to have any responsibility or liability for its South African subsidiaries. This we consider to be irresponsible.
Okay, that was a very interesting story that you've shared with us. Thank you for that.
May I interpose? I just want to interpose that it's one of the dumps of Mintails that they had partially remined, that is North Sands dump, where there was no access control at the time when the 8 women were raped. That was reported. It was reported that they were raped by Zamazamas or illegal miners. It, however, was found not to be the case, notwithstanding the fact that when there is no access control, of course, it does introduce criminal elements.
And just to go back to illegal mining, can you just take us through on how it actually affects the economy and the communities of South Africa? We might just be thinking with, you know, environmental issues, maybe air gets affected, whatever, but how deep is the damage that is caused by illegal miners?
We find that often where illegal mining takes place, the river systems, the soil becomes contaminated with mercury. It's toxic. We have done with the Hawks, we've done a site visit where some of the illegal miners had been apprehended in a residential and also in an agricultural community where the illegal miners have been leaching their gold in unlined earth dams with cyanide. That, of course, exposes the communities in that area to the cyanide, but not only that, also to downstream environments and ecosystems. Besides that, we also find that in some communities, they experience harassment from illegal miners. They may also experience criminal activities. So there's an introduction of fear within such a community. I may just mention that we have to differentiate between artisanal and small-scale mining, and therefore the policy that has been published by the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, that is the artisanal and small-scale mining policy, that recommended that there must be a differentiation between small-scale mining and also artisanal mining and also illegal mining. It also then proposed that all artisanal and small-scale mining must be conducted by South Africans, not by illegal foreigners. It also must be conducted by cooperatives, not individuals, cooperatives, and it must also be only for open cast mining or surface mining, not for deep mining, and that there should be a contract, agreements between large-scale miners and artisanal and small-scale miners, so that artisanal and small-scale miners can have access to equipment, can be have access to suppliers, to also be able to be educated in responsible environmental management, and that the government must train artisanal miners, and then furthermore that there should be a criminal prosecution of illegal miners, and that a specialised detective unit should be established in order to assist with the prosecution of illegal miners.
And then with that being said, what role do international buyers play in perpetuating those illegal mining activities?
Yes, it is very important that there be checks and balances in place when mining metals, whether it's diamonds, blood diamonds, or dirty gold, whether that is then sold to overseas buyers. So there must be checks and balances in place. What is very interesting that I was invited to present at the Basel University in Switzerland, and the conference was called, and if I may just refer to it, it was called the Basel Gold Day, How to Obtain Clean Gold, the Consumer's Perspective. And there was great emphasis put on that in Switzerland, the source of the gold must be established. That whole conference was arranged by Professor Mark Beath, and I think the reports are available, publicly available on that. So there are, at the moment, initiatives to ensure that the gold that is being purchased is clean gold. In other words, it's not illegally mined.
In what role should then the government, stakeholders, mining companies play in this to curb these illegal mining activities that are happening in South Africa? What is it that they should be doing, or they can do, or should be done?
What for us is important is that there should be a strategy developed and published, that the strategies should then translate into a policy, and the policy into a regulation that is legally enforceable, and that the strategy would be the National Mine Closure Strategy. Why we would promote that is because during mining, often there is not economic diversification or economic succession. So mining affected communities during mining, there may perhaps be benefits for a mining affected community. There can be infrastructure development. Municipalities often are assisted by mining companies during the life of mine. And besides that, there is often also residential developments that are being developed by mining companies for their mine workers. However, when a mining company closes, then often it results in significant challenges, socioeconomic challenges for both the municipality as well as mining affected communities. So we encourage and we hope that our Minister Gwede Matash will now sign off on this draft National Mine Closure Strategy that emphasizes economic succession and diversification during the life of mine. I am aware that there are mining companies such as, for example, Sibanye-Stillwater that are now promoting an future land use, a sustainable future land use, such as agro-industrial developments. Their program is referred to as the Bokamosa-Barona project. And also I am involved as an associate researcher with the Northwest University, where we are also researching economic activities in the form of tourism, heritage tourism, ecotourism, adventure tourism, as also a sustainable livelihood opportunity after the closure of mining companies. The gold mining industry is in decline, as we know. The last man standing will be Gold Fields with a life of mine of 80 years, but there will have to be future livelihood opportunities, medium and long-term benefits for mining-affected communities.
And then just going back to this 6,100 number of abandoned mines, is there any possibility of these mines being made active again, or some are just dead mines, and are they going to remain abandoned, or can they then be... can there be a solution for them to be properly closed off so that then the illegal miners do not have access on them anymore? Or what should happen actually to those 6,000 mines that are currently abandoned in South Africa?
The government is responsible for the rehabilitation of those areas, to make safe those areas. It is not just a matter of rehabilitation, it's also making safe of that those areas. In our current legislation, that is the legislation that was published in 1998, every person that causes, has caused, that is historically, or is likely to cause pollution or ecological degradation, must take reasonable measures to prevent pollution. If pollution cannot be prevented, it must then be mitigated and managed. In the case of the National Environmental Management Act, that every person includes a wide pool of persons. It includes managers, operators, it includes workers, it also includes companies and directors individually and collectively. So if those mine areas had been abandoned after 1998, then those persons, this wide pool of persons, are now being held responsible and liable, and so there should be criminal prosecution regarding that. Besides that, if there is mine dumps or mine sites that have been abandoned prior to our legislation, then the government takes responsibility. That, of course, includes many metal. It's asbestos, it's the gold mining, it's coal mining, it's the platinum group metals, it's other metals where it had been mined. So then government must take responsibility. However, it seems there are financial constraints for the mine, for the government to rehabilitate, so they do it in batches, and I am aware that there had been work done on the asbestosis mines. The Council of Jew Sons is also involved in looking at these mines that had been abandoned, and also to make recommendations to the Department of Mineral Resources regarding the rehabilitation of these areas.
And then when it comes to communities who are living within these abandoned mines where there's illegal mining activities happening, what powers do they have, or what is it that they can do in helping to make sure that those activities come to an end and stuff like that? So how do communities take back their power when it comes to illegal mining?
First of all, we must remember that the right to an environment that is not harmful to health and well-being is enshrined in our Bill of Rights. Yeah. It's Section 24 of the Constitution. So communities do have that right. It's a basic human right. So for that reason, in terms of Section 31 of our National Environmental Management Act, if communities become aware of environmental risks, they have the right to then whistleblow this, in other words, to disclose to both the news media the risks, to whistleblow it to any department that deals with the environment, to whistleblow it to the parliamentary portfolio committees, to whistleblow it to the public protector, to also disclose it to the South African Human Rights Commission, in order for these organs of state or these bodies to investigate and to take action. If they fail to do this, then the communities have the right to act on behalf of the environment, on behalf of the public, on behalf of themselves or a group of persons, and to lay criminal charges at a police station. Then the National Prosecuting Authority is then required to investigate and to prosecute. That, of course, is without any risk of prosecution for the whistleblower. Section 31 and Section 32 make provision for the whistleblowing without risk of harassment, intimidation, or prosecution. If that complaint is done without being unreasonable, frivolous, or vexatious, then no cost orders can be brought against community members. So, besides these provisions, of course, there's also the provision of petitions, of protests, and there is another provision made of, I'm sorry, what is it, when you just stand with a placard, I can't recall the other, but there are provisions in our law, and then there's no risk of prosecution for these whistleblowers or activists. Activists can also be assisted, of course, by public law firms, where public law firms on a pro bono basis would also assist with court applications.
Yeah. So when it comes to economic costs, how much damage has the illegal mining done to the economy of South Africa? How much has the country lost in revenue and
hundreds of millions or billions of rand. I think the Industrial Council have the figures available, what had been lost in order for the revenue to flow towards our country, that is the gross domestic product. But of course, we must also take into consideration the externalized costs. It's not just the direct cost, but the indirect cost, the cost to the environment, the cost to our river systems, the cost to the safety and security of our communities. These are the indirect costs, the externalized costs that are being currently carried by our communities and by the environment, the mute environment. The environment cannot speak. So these costs must also be calculated, and it definitely will be a significant cost.
And with that being said, through your research, is there, because I know most countries where there's mines, there are sort of illegal mining issues that they are dealing with. But is there a country or a nation that is better handling the illegal mining problem?
We are working with Evarista Umba. He's a PhD student.
Okay.
And with the University of Johannesburg. He supervises our professors at the University of Johannesburg. And he is calling on artisanal miners to use safer methods of leaching the mine, the gold, not the use of mercury or cyanide. And that is his PhD research, and he is from the DRC. And he had been informing us that in certain African countries, they do allow for artisanal and small-scale mining, but again, it is only for local people, in other words, not for foreigners. And it seems that there had been some successes in that regard, where indigenous people can do artisanal and small-scale mining. Our only concern is, of course, that environmental laws must also be applicable to artisanal and small-scale mining. After mining, there must be a sustainable environment. We have often found that mining companies move on, or miners move on, whether it's legal or illegal miners, they move on leaving gaping holes in the ground, polluted rivers, and unenriched and disrupted communities. That, of course, is not acceptable.
In closing, what would you emphasize so that as South Africa, we then win against this illegal mining? What would, through your research, through the work that you've done, what is it that needs to be emphasized or done or pay attention to in order for us to just win against this illegal mining?
Artisanal and small-scale mining, the policy must translate into regulations. It must be enforced. The Department of Mineral Resources is the competent authority in this regard. There should be criminal prosecution if there is, for example, illegal mining through criminal syndicates. And at the same time, artisanal miners must be assisted by government and also by large-scale miners. So I think that is the proposals within the artisanal and small-scale mining. The proposals in the national mine closure strategy, that must translate into regulations and that must be enforced, diligently enforced by our Department of Mineral Resources and also by the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment and Department of Water and Sanitation. I think that is important. We must have an active government to ensure that the rights of our people, and the, here I specifically refer to the vulnerable people, the people that are perhaps marginalised, that their rights must be protected. After all, that is enshrined in the Bill of Rights and in Section 24 of the Constitution, the right to an environment that is not harmful to health and well-being.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today, Maria Clifferink. The conversation that we had was very insightful, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us on this episode.
And thank you for inviting us.
Of course, and I'm still going to invite you for more conversation.
Thank you.
With that being said, that was Mariette Lifferink, CEO of the Federation for a Sustainable Environment, and she took us through the illegal mining in South Africa, and she shared her thoughts on what can be done in order to curb this problem that South Africa is currently facing. And then with that being said, I'd like to just thank my team, Kamohelo Malangabi, Chweni Sitage, and Musa Baloyi. I'd also like to thank MENA, which is our sponsor, for making this podcast possible. Thank you so much, and do tune in again.